When we go back and read our history and discover how the founders put the system together, we find that there are two more separate powers that are just fantastic powers, and they're the most powerful separate powers in the entire system. And of course, I talked about the grand jury and the trial jury over here, but I did not bring out how that the grand jury and the trial jury, what they are separate powers, and that they have the authority to be a check against the government. They have a check against that. They're a check against that monster. But I'm going to concentrate on this chart over here for this segment of this TV production. Now, the grand jury goes over here. The trial jury goes over here. Now, if you will remember the schematic that we had here on the difference between a democracy and a republic, the people were up above the Constitution, and that's the way it is here. Well, the grand jury is a separate power above the Constitution. The president, the congressmen, the senators, the judiciary, the judges, all of those hundreds of federal judges in this country, they're all below the Constitution. The grand jury is above the Constitution. The petit jury, the trial jury, they are above the Constitution. Why? Because it is made up of we the people up here. They're the ones who serve on grand juries. They're the ones who serve on trial juries. And they are the creators of the Constitution. So they're not going to put themselves below the Constitution. Now, if we the people up here, if we don't know about our authority, if we do not understand our proper position in this order of authority, this pecking order, then the grand jury is down here on the floor someplace. It isn't even on the picture here. The grand jury is down there on the floor. That's where it's functioning today. This is not what we have today in this nation. The grand jury isn't up here. Although in Montana back in the decade of the 80s, we had 4 years out of the 10 years of the 80s where the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Justice Department in Montana, was unable to get a grand jury indictment of anyone for tax evasion. Why? Very simple. Because we went on television and we taught the people of Montana about their power on grand juries and the trial juries. And it was very, very effective. And this video that is being produced right now is going to be very, very effective because we're going to go right into the living room of Joe Sixpack, and he, for the first time in his life, he's going to understand that he is in a position here where he can be a check. Why is the grand jury a separate power? Very simple. You take all of the people in the executive branch of government. I understand there are over 20 million people now who work for the federal government in one way or another, and most of them are in the executive branch, the administrative branch of government. You take all of those millions of public servants. You take all of the congressmen. There's 435 congressmen. There's 100 U.S. senators. Take all of their staff. Put them all together with all of those judges on the federal bench at the district court level, the appellate level, and the U.S. Supreme Court. You can take all of that conglomeration of government, put them all together, and you cannot find the power. They don't have the authority to indict anybody. What is an indictment? They didn't teach you that in the government school because they didn't want you to know. In the Declaration of Independence, again, it says, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Deriving their just powers. Where do they get their unjust powers? They get their unjust powers also from the consent of the governed, but they are getting unjust powers from a misinformed or disinformed public out there. The people are not informed, and so they are giving their consent. We have grand juries that are not functioning up here where they belong. They're down here because they don't know their authority. Now, suppose that we have one of us, one of our countrymen here. He is a very productive American. He's a small businessman, perhaps. He's got a machine shop or something. He's a craftsman. He takes great pride in being a productive American. And I want you to pay particular attention to the fact that the IRS, they never harass the unproductive. It is only the productive in this country who are being harassed. And the productive, you see, are a minority. You see, you've got all of these government servants down here. You have all of the welfare. You have all of the people that are getting a government check, and there's over 50%, they tell us, that now get some kind of a government subsidy or whatever. The productive individual is a minority. You are not going to be able to control anything with your vote on election day if you're a productive American. It is not going to happen. So, we have a productive individual, and he's up here. He's one of us. And he, at some point, decides that he has suffered enough. He says, every April 15th, I have to write a check to the Internal Revenue Service, which is nothing more than a fine, a penalty for being a productive American. And he says, I've had enough. I've seen all of this waste. I have seen in my local newspaper about Air Force buying $2,000 toilet seats and $5,000 coffee makers, $350 hammers that he can buy at the hardware store for $10. He says, I just can't afford this kind of government anymore. And he quits filing. He gets himself informed. He gets himself a soapbox, and he gets up on the soapbox, and he tells his fellow Americans, say, hey, we have a criminal government. It goes for 4 or 5 years, and he becomes more active. He's doing the radio talk shows. He's writing letters to the editor. He's passing out pamphlets and books. And he gets the attention of the Internal Revenue Service, and they're down here in the executive branch of government. They say, man, we've got to silence this fellow up here. I call him Mr. A. He's a great A American. And he's up here. And he's speaking out, which is his right and his duty. He's speaking out. The IRS, they go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, who is also down here in this executive branch of government. And they decide that they want to prosecute Mr. A. But they cannot prosecute Mr. A without the consent of the governed. So they have to come up to the grand jury and get the consent of our representatives on the grand jury. They're supposed to be representing us, not the IRS, not the government. They're supposed to be representing us. Now, when your state legislature, when the Congress, when they pass rules and regulations, say your state legislature, they create traffic laws. What do? Do they just write them in the book and forget them? No. When they write a rule or a statute, they send out their employees. They send out the highway patrol, don't they, to enforce the statutes that they create. The speed limits and all the rest, right? Now, whenever they write law, they send out enforcement people. When we the people wrote a law, the Constitution, who did we send out there to enforce the law we wrote? That's what these people are there for. They're our special law enforcement people, our special law enforcement representatives. They're on that grand jury. And they're supposed to be enforcing the Constitution for the United States of America and making these people down here comply with the law that was written to govern them. very, very simple when you recognize that we are up here above the Constitution, the grand jury's above it, and these people are there to be law enforcement people, not a rubber stamp in the hands of the Justice Department or a federal judge. These people here, when they come up here to ask for an indictment against Mr. A, they listen to the evidence, and then they tell the U.S. Attorney and the IRS, they say, now you go back to your office, servants. They need to exercise their authority. They need to make sure that that U.S. Attorney and the IRS understand that they are the boss. The U.S. Attorney and the IRS, they're public servants. And so they dismiss them. Now, they say, do we want to indict Mr. A? Well, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to check out the IRS code. Now, that's down here because it was created by our public servants, right? So the case and the statute law, it's all down here at the bottom because these people are the creators of it. So it's down here. And so they say, is the IRS code, is it in compliance with the Constitution for the United States of America? Well, you have some informed people on that grand jury because they're up here. And so one of the people on the grand jury says, well, you know, he says, I have a real serious problem because Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution here, it says the Congress, these people here, that they shall have the power to lay and collect taxes. This grand jury person says, I have a real serious problem with that because Article 1, Section 8 says that the Congress shall collect the taxes, and I find that the IRS is over here in the executive branch of government. This seems like a clear violation of the Constitution for the United States of America. So the grand jury, they discuss that and they say, you know, that makes sense. The Congress, they're the ones that spend the money. And the founders, they figured that out. They said, if the Congress spends the money, then they should be the ones who have to collect it. The Internal Revenue Service office should be a part of your local congressman's office. Your congressman and the IRS, their offices should be in the same building right together. So that if you have a problem with a particular IRS agent, you just tell that IRS agent, say, well, I'm going to go talk to my congressman. So you go over across the aisle and you talk to a staff member over there that is in the staff of the congressman and you say, staff member, come with me. We have a public servant over here that is completely out of hand and I want you to make a correction over here. How long would these people, how many times would these people be re-elected to the Congress if the Internal Revenue collection was done right out of their office back home? I can assure you they wouldn't be re-elected if the IRS was operating the way they do today. They'd have to be pretty nice guys, wouldn't they? The founders had a lot of good common sense. So the grand jury, they say, well, that's enough right there. We don't need anything more. We can call back the U.S. Attorney and say, Mr. U.S. Attorney, we are not going to indict Mr. A because this law you've got down here, we're going to say your law is of no effect until you people down here comply with the Constitution. We want you to come under that Constitution where you belong. We want you to get the IRS out of the executive branch of government and back over here into the legislative branch of government as per Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution. Now, they may want to go a little farther. Now, there's a lot of problems here with the IRS code. They say, well, the Fifth Amendment says that you have to have due, they got to give you due process. The Fifth Amendment says that you can, you know, you have the right to get proper I can't think of the proper term right at the moment, but you have the right to be compensated. The Fifth Amendment was put there by we the people to protect us from government. These people, they say, well, the Fourth Amendment, they say the IRS manual says that every IRS audit is an illegal search and seizure under the Fourth Amendment. They say this lower law has to be trash canned because it is in violation of the Constitution. And they can go a little farther. They say, well, let's take a look at the higher laws up here. How about the laws of grammar? Well, you already know that we have a violation there because the law, the IRS code says we have a voluntary tax system, right? And they're trying to prosecute. They want to send Mr. A to jail for not volunteering. So they say, well, we've got a problem there. Well, then the laws of common sense. Common sense tells us that if you take too much away from Mr. A and the other productive people in this country, if you take too much of their production away from them, what happens? They quit producing. Common sense tells you that, doesn't it? Now, if the IRS code was in compliance with the Constitution, if the IRS code was in compliance with the laws of grammar, if for no other reason than the fact that their common sense tells them that it is inhibiting, it is restricting productivity in this country, they can refuse to indict Mr. A for no other reason. How about God's law? God says you return to him 10% of your production and he'll take care of the whole mess. He'll take care of all of it. And the founders, they had a war of independence when King George took 14%. And the grand jury says, this government down here has violated our trust. They're taxing our kids and our unborn generations to come before they're ever old enough to vote. That's taxation without representation. They say, we are not going to indict Mr. A because we're going to protect Mr. A. We're going to enforce the Constitution. We're going to enforce these higher laws. This lower law is not in compliance with the higher laws. Suppose you have a grand jury that is not functioning properly. A grand jury that is not a check. You see, that grand jury that will refuse to indict Mr. A, that grand jury that refuses to indict Mr. A is being a check against the President of the United States and the administrative branch of government. That grand jury that refuses to indict is a check against a Congress that is made up of vote thieves. That grand jury will be a check against the judiciary. The arrogance of the federal judiciary today must be checked. We must check them. And this is the vote that we use to do it. Now, if your grand jury is down there on the floor, being nothing but a rubber stamp for public servants down here, that grand jury will indict Mr. A, and then he has to go to trial over here in a criminal trial in federal court. And it is happening hundreds of times across this nation. And Mr. A is not going to be able to present the evidence that he needs to defend himself with, because that judge is going to look out for the interests of government. And the best interests of government say that that jury must not be allowed to hear the truth. They must not be allowed to hear the truth, because if they hear the truth in that courtroom, they are going to rule against the government. Every decision that we have seen come out of the Congress, out of the executive branch, out of the judiciary in the last 50 years, almost without exception, has been in favor of government and against the people of this nation. It has been a downhill slide because we the people have not been exercising our power on these grand juries and on the trial jury. Now here is the beauty of what I have been trying to teach you today. If that grand jury does not function, and if they indict Mr. A, he goes to trial in that courtroom, and if we can reach just one person out of every 20 in this country with this message, I'm not talking about meeting or reaching a majority of the people like a democracy, where we have to try to change the people, the faces in the Congress or in the Senate and in the White House. No, we can do it with just 5% of our fellow Americans, our countrymen, understanding the principles that I am talking about here at this point in time. Because all we need on this jury over here, this Pettit jury, is just one informed American. And it's a strange thing about that one informed American. They've got a stronger backbone. They've got a harder head. And not only that, but they have a concern for their country and their countrymen, and they will carry that over into the deliberations in that deliberation room after they take the case and go back to come to their decision. Back in 1980, in February of 1980, we had a trial in Great Falls, Montana. The IRS had managed to get an indictment against a farmer. They had him with 3 felony counts being tried for tax evasion. They had set this man up like a pigeon. He didn't have a chance. They had all of his records. They had gone to great extremes to set up a case that was just absolutely airtight for them. They went through that trial, and the jury took that case about 3 o'clock of an afternoon. They deliberated until late in the evening. I had not been able to attend the trial. I was 220 or 30 miles away, and I was staying very close to my telephone, waiting for the news. The IRS, during the trial, during the evidence, had admitted that they had tried to make this farmer commit suicide. I had spent about 2 hours with this man in the restaurant of the Holiday Inn in Great Falls, Montana one day, explaining to him why he dared not to commit suicide. If it hadn't been for his friends and his family, his neighbors just literally hanging on to him, there would not have been a trial. The IRS would have ended up with everything that he had, including his farm. That's what they wanted. And that jury went out, and I didn't hear anything. That jury deliberated late into the evening, and then they came back the next day and all day long. And I stayed close to my phone. I knew. We had been running those television across the state of Montana, explaining basically what I'm explaining to you today. About 5 o'clock, I got that phone call. The jury just came out. Not guilty on all 3 counts. The young prosecutor threw a tantrum in the courtroom. He said, "How could you come out with such a verdict?" Well, we found out the first vote in the jury room was 11-1 for conviction. A little gray-haired grandmother had voted not guilty. I can just visualize those other 11 on the jury turning to that little gray-haired grandmother and saying, "Lady, what in the world is the matter with you? This guy violated the law." He had violated the lower law. But it just so happens this lower law is not good law. It is not valid law. It is law that needs to be trash canned. And that little gray-haired grandmother, she started talking. And right away, one of the other ladies on the jury said, "Yeah, I heard about that. I heard about that." And so the next vote was 10-2. And when that jury came out, it was 12 votes not guilty on all counts. We don't have to have this absolutely impossible majority that it takes to control the Congress to get rid of that bad law. We don't need a majority to elect a president who will sign a law that eliminates the Internal Revenue Service and the graduated income tax. We don't need that. We don't need to change all the faces on the federal bench. All we have to do is educate our fellow countrymen to where we can have that 1 out of 20, because you see, 65% of our fellow Americans aren't even registered to vote. They've given up on the system. And then you've got all these people that don't want to serve on the jury. They'll make all kinds of excuses. But you see, the individual who has the information is not going to try to get off of that jury. He's not going to make excuses. That individual who has the information is going to put on a blank face. He's going to go into that courtroom determined to get on that jury. He is not going to say anything or do anything that would jeopardize his opportunity to be on that jury. Here about 3 years ago, we had a very critical case. The government wanted to prosecute a very high-profile tax protester. They had him charged with about 8 different indictments. That trial went on for several days. Then it went to the jury, and the jury went through a day of deliberations. Then they went through another day. Then they went through another day, and they finally came out not guilty on all counts. We found out we had a retired military man who came to that courthouse on that trial date. He was noticed that he was to be on the jury panel, and he said, "I was determined to get on that jury." And he was able to get on that jury. And he informed the other 11, and they came out not guilty on all counts. This is what we need to see in this country. This is what we're going to have to see in this country if we want to solve the Federal Reserve Bank problem. All of these different problems that are confronting us, the different agencies, OSHA, and all the rest of them. This is how we are going to have to do it. And we're going to have to put ourselves up here at that position, in this position where we can use our votes to turn the system around. You've been a very good audience, and I thank you. Back a few years ago, a number of years ago, back about 1976 and 77, we started having meetings in such as this in the Holiday Inn Convention Center back in Billings, Montana, where I come from. And we had run a TV special, and we had a very nice crowd that showed up the next night at a meeting there in that convention center. We had about 450 people. And, of course, I was teaching the jury principle and the function of the jury. But that night I got up there and introduced myself to that crowd, and I said something that I thought at the moment was rather funny. I said, I want to welcome all of you IRS agents that are here. At that point in time, we had IRS agents that attended most of our meetings. And I said, I want to welcome all you IRS agents that are here. And of course, today, right here now, if we have an IRS agent here, I want to welcome you here. But back there, I made a mistake. I said, I'm glad to have you here, but we can't guarantee your safety. There were about 450 people there, and there were three fellows in the audience that jumped up like they'd set on attack or something and ran out the door. Everybody laughed. I mean, those fellows gave themselves away. I like to have IRS agents in our audiences, and I like to have U.S. attorneys, and I don't know if I've ever had a federal judge, but I would hope so. I do know that we ran a one-hour TV special back in New Hampshire. It cost me $7,000 to run that one-hour TV special in Manchester, New Hampshire, back in about February of 1984. We ran that program, a one-hour TV special, and we titled it Hope for America. We didn't get too much response from that program, but I got one letter that made it all worthwhile. I got a letter from one of the justices of the Supreme Court for the state of New Hampshire on the Supreme Court stationery, and he said this. He says, I watched your TV special, and he said, I want you to know that I agree that you are 100% right in what you're saying. That made it all worthwhile. You see, that $7,000, I was investing in my country. I wasn't investing in a criminal government. I was investing in my country because I am convinced that my grandchildren will get a much better return on that kind of an investment than if I were to have bought stocks or bonds or whatever and passed those on to my heirs when I die. I am interested in making an investment that will pay off in the future. And I do not believe that I can invest any better than investing in the process of informing my fellow Americans. Now, I have some questions here that you folks have put out here. You've been writing these in the last hour, hour and a half, and I am not going to be able to address them all. But I'm going to address the ones that I think are most important and the ones that will go with what I have been saying here today. The first question is this. Can you explain how the grand jury is seated? Who picks the members? That is a very good question, a very vital question. We know that we have a criminal system out there in the Justice Department and the federal judges. They are manipulating the thing at times. We know that. We have a question in here telling about how the U.S. attorney fired the foreman of a grand jury here in this area because apparently he was not working with the U.S. attorney. He was working for the country rather than for the government. That question is in here too. But I want to address this, how the grand jury is supposedly, or it is supposed to be picked. The federal grand jury is to be picked from the voter registration list. The same process as they use to pick the juries for the petit juries, the criminal trials, the civil trials. They're supposed to pick them by lot. However, we know in some places in this country they have manipulated this, and in other places they have followed the law. In Montana, back about 1979 or 80, I was talking to the U.S. attorney, and he told me, he said, Red, he says, we have held the last federal grand jury over an additional 6 months because we were afraid we would get a tax protester on the next grand jury. That's one of the things that they are doing. That kind of mischief will continue until we get grand juries informed. People on those grand juries, like the grand jury foreman that was fired here by the U.S. attorney, if the rest of that grand jury had been functioning properly, they would have immediately called in the U.S. attorney. When the U.S. attorney tried to fire the foreman, the rest of the grand jury should have immediately called in the U.S. attorney, put him under oath, and questioned him as to his authority. Where did he get the authority to fire the foreman of the grand jury? You know what would have happened if they had been informed and known? The U.S. attorney would have been charged with a felony. You see, he doesn't have that authority. You remember now? Where is the authority? Is it above? Yes. It is above the U.S. attorney. The grand jury has the authority, not the U.S. attorney. We had a federal grand jury in Salt Lake that handed down some indictments against the Federal Reserve Bank system back a few years ago. They did not understand their position properly. When the U.S. attorney dismissed their first indictment, they should have indicted the U.S. attorney. obstruction of justice. When the judge dismissed their second indictment, they should have indicted him. The grand jury's up here, the judge is down here. What does that mean? It's just like the grand jury here, they're bird colonels in the military. And the judge is some kind of a corporal or a sergeant down here. Now, who has control? Who is in command? If you are in the military and if you had a corporal with an IQ of 80, and I think most of us have seen a few of them, if you had a corporal with an IQ of 80 and you had a million privates and all of them had an IQ averaging 130, who would be in command? Not the smartest ones, not the million out there, the majority, no. Because there is an order of authority, there is a chain of command in the military. And it is there so that there is a discipline in the system. And that corporal with his 80 IQ is in command. I know we have military, former military people here. And you understand exactly what I'm saying. The grand jury is up here. They should not be taking any guff off of these people down here. Back several years ago, they had a special grand jury impaneled in Salt Lake City, Utah, and they had seven notorious high-profile tax protesters from the West, I was not one of them, that they had targeted. And they spent tax dollars like they were going out of style. They subpoenaed witnesses from all over the United States. A young fellow came out to my house. He said, I've got this subpoena. I have to go to Salt Lake and appear before the grand jury. He was at a loss. He was frightened. He was intimidated. He didn't know what to expect. And so I set him down and explained the facts of life to him. I said, they don't want you. They're after somebody else. I knew about that grand jury. I knew what was happening. They were bringing in all these people, flying them into Salt Lake, putting them up in the hotels, and they were feeding them and everything else and flying them back home. I said, you don't have any answers to any questions that they're looking for. They're going to ask you a couple of questions, and then they're going to release you and fly you back to Billings, Montana. I said, you have nothing to worry about as far as you being a target. You're not a target. They want to see if you've got some evidence they can use against these high-profile tax protesters out here. So I set him down, and I explained a few things to him. I used the tax audit guide. I showed him the forward by the commissioner of the IRS. I showed him the section about the tax and or the books and records of the individual and how that an audit is an illegal search and seizure. It violates the Fifth Amendment. You have to waive your Fifth Amendment rights if you're going to file a 1040. I explained all this, and of course this was 1984. We had all of the file on the 16th Amendment fraud that had been put together by the farmers, ranchers, and business people up in Montana that called themselves the Montana Historians. I had that file, and I showed him the legislative journals for several of the states and how that they had not ratified the 16th Amendment, the income tax. And then I gave him the file. I gave him copies of my book, Born Again Republic, the one doing to the IRS as they would do unto you, Church Deceived. I gave him copies of all of this, that tax audit guide. I said, you go into that grand jury hearing and take all of this material with you. They're only going to ask you a couple of questions, and then they're going to try to hustle you right out because they've got all these people there waiting to testify. And I said, please, at some point, I said, you've got to play it by ear. At some point, you say, wait a minute. I would like to talk to this grand jury in private, without the U.S. attorney, without the prosecutor here. I didn't know if this young fellow, I think he was about 26 or 7 years old, and he didn't know anything, really. He didn't know very much. I didn't know if he would do it. I was afraid he'd go in there just shaking in his boots. But you know, He went in there, and they asked him two questions, and they were going to hustle him out. And he said, wait a minute. I'd like to talk to this grand jury in private without the U.S. attorney in here. And the U.S. attorney was caught completely off guard. Well, that's up to the foreman of the grand jury. And the foreman of the grand jury said, yes, we would like to talk to you. And he took about 10 to 15 minutes, and he went into that tax audit guide. He showed them what the tax audit guide had to say. He showed them the file on the 16th Amendment material and how that there was a fraud perpetrated against the American people. And then he said, now, if you would like to have all of this material, I will give it to you. And they were so glad to get that material. And he went out the door and came back to Montana. That grand jury deliberated for an entire year and did not return one single indictment. We're confident they spent millions because they wanted to just absolutely devastate the tax protest leadership in the West. And there was a grand jury that protected those people. Why and how? Very simple. They were able to get some truth. They were able to get some information that allowed them to function the way they're supposed to function. I better go on with these questions. Serving on the grand jury is a full-time job. 1 year, every day, 9 to 5. He says, I would love to serve, but I have to make a living. First of all, they pay you to serve on that grand jury. But in most cases, it is not a 9-to-5 everyday type of situation. In Los Angeles, with all the crime you have, it probably is. However, I believe that no matter what the sacrifice is, and if anyone in the Patriot community is called for grand jury duty, I would hope that the rest of the Patriot community would jump in there and take up the slack and support this individual financially, if at all possible, to make sure that this individual can serve on that grand jury. Because that grand jury juror member has the opportunity to educate his fellow jurors, grand jurors. Just a week ago last Saturday, I was in Des Moines, Iowa for a meeting. And they had a speaker there that had just been on a federal grand jury in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for 18 months. And he was rather proud of the fact that at the end of their 12 months, the U.S. attorney wanted them to serve an additional 6 months. And it was really kind of painful to have to tell him that the reason that the U.S. attorney wanted them to serve an extra 6 months was because it was a rubber stamp grand jury. They like rubber stamps. And that grand jury had been so willing to serve the U.S. attorney down here, that grand jury, they weren't up here. That grand jury was down here. If you've got a grand jury up here, I can assure you that the U.S. attorney is not going to ask you to serve another 6 months. And so it was kind of painful to kind of communicate with, I had to be very diplomatic and communicate with this fellow and say, hey, the reason they wanted you another 6 months was because you were doing everything they told you. You were a bunch of puppets on the strings, and the strings were controlled by the U.S. attorney. Can a juryman vote against the law? That's not the right term. Now, one of the terms that is used is jury nullification. That's not really the best term either. Now, we talked about the legislative branch of government having the authority, the power, the exclusive, separate power to legislate. They create legislation and it goes to the president, and it does not become law until the president signs it. If the president does not agree with the legislative branch of government, he has veto power. veto power. The legislative branch of government then, if they can muster enough votes, they can override the veto and it will become law. Now what I'm talking about here is that system of checks and balances. The president is to be a check against the legislative branch of government. He is to use his power of signing a bill or legislation that he is to use his veto power as a check against the legislative branch of government. They, in turn, the legislative branch, they can use their power to override the veto as a check against the president. And then, of course, after the president, if he signs a bill or the Congress overrides a veto, then the courts will usually get a crack at it to say whether it is constitutional or unconstitutional. The grand jury, by refusing to indict, by refusing to enforce this lower law, they have literally vetoed that law in that particular case. Now, the president, when he vetoes it, it has great coverage and it covers the entire law. In the grand jury's case, it is only pertaining to that one case that is before them. So, you have a situation here where the law, in some cases, might be proper. But you may have a law here that the U.S. attorney, he has a vendetta against somebody, and he's trying to use the law down here to punish somebody, and the grand jury, they see through that, and they say, no, we're not going to indict, because that's not a proper application of the law. The big thing, however, for this grand jury is to recognize they're supposed to judge the law, this lower law created by the legislative branch, signed by the president, adjudicated to be constitutional. That is lower law. Their responsibility is to examine that law carefully and judge that law. Put the law on trial. The difference between a free society and an authoritarian type of government is the people in a free society must retain the right to judge the law. Where they don't have the right to judge the law, you will have the authoritarian, the dictatorship type of government. In this nation, the judges, the congressman, the president are not going to tell you that you have the right to judge the law. That's your job and mine, is to reach our countrymen with that information. The fact that we have the right to judge the law. Another question, what is common law? There is considerable confusion about common law. There are two very well-defined kinds of common law. One is called English common law. The other is called Anglo-Saxon common law. And they are directly opposite of each other. If you will look in your Volume 1 of your revised codes of the state of California, I believe every single state has the same clause. Volume 1, right very nearly to the beginning of the book, you will see this. It will read like this. It will say, if a controversy arises not covered by the statutes of your state, you revert back to the English common law. The English common law says that the people are down here and that the government is free. The English common law says that the government has the authority. The Anglo-Saxon common law, that's where your grand juries and your trial juries came into being. The Anglo-Saxon common law says that the people, that they are sovereign, and that the king or the government is subject to the people. Now that's quite a difference, isn't it? Remember I said there's only two kinds of government? You have government controlled by people, or people controlled by government. That's the only kind. I don't care what kind of a label you put on it. democracy, Nazism, socialism, communism, or whatever. You see, it doesn't make any difference if you are executed by a bullet in the back of the head. It doesn't make one bit of difference to you. You're dead. It isn't going to make any difference whether that bullet says democracy. That's what happened to Vicki Weaver up in northern Idaho. That was a democracy. And her son Sammy shot in the back. That bullet said democracy on it. Those people down there in Waco, all those little kids, murdered. It had democracy written all over that atrocity. It could have had communist label on it. It doesn't make any difference. Waco happened because we the people lost control of our government. Common law. I talk about the laws of common sense. Every individual out there, if they have normal mental capacity, has it right between their heads, right between their ears. It's there. Why? Because your God Creator put it there. Your mother, at your mother's knee, should have been teaching you the difference between right and wrong. They should be teaching you right from wrong in the schools, but that's why we have problems in our schools today, because they say, oh, we can't teach these values. The government schools have to go. The laws of common sense, those are laws that we have readily available, and we function under those laws every day of our lives. Here's the one about the district attorney fired the head of the grand jury, and I've already touched on that. Here's one that's kind of close to my heart. How can your research into the improper ratification of the 16th Amendment gain judicial notice? It was in 1980, June of 1980. I was talking to on the phone late at night with a fellow up in Montana who had become very active because of our television specials. And we were talking and discussing things, and of course I was using, way back then, I was challenging audiences to tell me one time where our tax-consuming public servants had told us the truth on any major story in this century. I've recited that long list of lies many, many times, even on national television. We've been on satellite television before. They lied about Pearl Harbor, Korea, Vietnam, Social Security, energy shortage, Watergate, Kennedy assassination, and on and on and on. And this fellow says, you don't suppose they lied to us about the ratification of the 16th Amendment? That is the amendment that supposedly gave the Congress the power to lay a tax on our incomes. I said, Sam, we have to know from their track record, we have to understand, we have to know that it is a fraud. He said, we better get the evidence. We better collect the research. We better research this. We better collect the evidence. We better get the legislative journals from the 48 states that we had in 1913. And so that was the birth of an ad hoc type of a group of people that said, we're going to do research. We're going to collect the evidence of criminal activity by our public servants. And they started to gather up all of these legislative documents, the arguments, the debates, I should say, and the votes of the various state legislatures. By the time I wrote my book, Born Again Republic, in 1981, we knew that the 16th Amendment had not been ratified. The evidence had not been completed until January of 83. And when I took it into federal court the first time in March of 83, they refused to accept it because they said it was not certified. So Mr. Bill Benson from South Holland, in the Chicago area, South Holland, Illinois, he went out and went to all of the 48 states. Judge Moody in federal court in June of 1980, I testified, and he said, you've got to have a witness that'll testify that he's gone to all the states and gathered all this information. They put up a bunch of hoops for us to jump through, and we jumped through every single one, and it cost us about $100,000 to do it. But when Bill Benson completed the journey, the sojourn across the United States, we had over 17,000 certified documents. We put this book together, Volume 1, The Law That Never Was. Back there, about 1987, every single congressman, every senator was given a copy of this book with their name gold embossed on the cover. This is a beautiful book. I'm not one bit ashamed of it, I'll tell you that. We are not going to get this evidence out here and make it work until we can get a grand jury in this country that will take this evidence and start indicting federal judges for violation of their oath. They're violating Title 18, Section 4, misprison of felony. They're violating it every day in this country. Bill completed that evidence in Christmas Eve of 1984. We had this book out in April of 1985. And we have been confronting the courts across this land, the U.S. attorneys and the federal judges, since that time. And at this point in time, I am absolutely convinced that every federal judge and U.S. attorney in this country is guilty of a felony. It will not be corrected until we have our grand juries start investigating, researching, and then indicting these people for violations of the supreme law and the laws of our land. This is why we must inform our fellow Americans with the truth that I have brought to you at this time. Thank you, and go out and let's do the job.